This is Don Hassig with Cancer Action Network. You're listening to Loving the Earth, Pollution Free Revolution. Ann Alexander is a Natural Resources Defense Council attorney. She's based in their Midwest office. I spoke with Ann over a year ago about her litigation, her Clean Air Act litigation against the BP Whiting facility. How are things going with that project, Ann?
Well, I think they're going quite well. The EPA did exactly what we asked them to do and told the Indiana Department of Environmental Management, which had issued the bad permit in the first place, that they needed to go back to the drawing board and do it right.
Okay. Does the Clean Air Act protect the public from harm in cases where facilities such as the BP Whiting, this huge refinery, where facilities with large quantities of pollutant releases seek to expand their operations and therefore increase their releases? You know, this is a very large refinery and it wants to become a much larger refinery. And it's because of the intention to utilize the tar sands crude feedstock. And let's try to get a little bit of background going on that too as we move along here. But what about this matter of the Clean Air Act and protecting the public health?
It absolutely protects the public from exactly that. There is a portion of the Clean Air Act called the New Source Review Program. And just to give you a bit of history on that, it emerged back in the 1970s when the Clean Air Act was young, and everyone was trying to figure out when they were going to require polluting facilities to put on the latest pollution control equipment. And the environmentalists said, well, we have it, and they should put it on now. Let's stop the pollution. And industry, as they tended to do in the 70s, screamed bloody murder and said, no, if you make us do that, then we'll go bankrupt and Western civilization will collapse. And the compromise that was reached was essentially grandfathering existing facilities temporarily out of the requirement to put on modern pollution control equipment. But the idea was they can't keep running forever. Either they're going to upgrade themselves, in which case they will have to put on the pollution control equipment, or else they're going to shut down. The problem was that a lot of these facilities just flat out didn't obey that law. They would expand surreptitiously or in ways that they hoped nobody would notice, and therefore they wouldn't end up putting on the pollution control equipment. So there was a push by US EPA to enforce new source review. And what happened at the Whiting facility was kind of very much in that vein, except it was citizen enforcement in this case. What happened was the BP Whiting facility, as you mentioned, plans to expand to take this very dirty crude. One would think rationally, and one would be right, that when you do that, you increase your pollution. But the Clean Air Act regulations implementing new source review also allow you to do, the technical term is netting, and that just means that if you want to shut down stuff to counterbalance what you're increasing, you can weigh the one against the other. And if you can keep your pollution from increasing that way, you don't have to install the pollution control equipment. Well, as you can imagine, that system leaves a lot of room for, well, let's just say funny math. And that's what happened here, is that the facility said, well, it would be really expensive and time-consuming to put on modern pollution control equipment. So what they did is they vastly overestimated how much pollution they were going to get rid of when they shut a few things down, all kinds of just wrong inflated estimates there. And then they didn't count significant sources of additional pollution they were going to have when they expanded. And there were a whole bunch of them. Refineries are very complicated, but I think that the most obvious and egregious one was that they were building three new flare stacks, which are those big towers with the flames on top of them, at refineries. And they're very polluting because the pollution essentially comes out of there unfiltered. It's what you do when you have excess gas because something went wrong and you have to send it somewhere and they burn it in the flare stack. Just vast pollution comes out of those. They were building the three new flare stacks, and yet when they calculated their emissions, they assumed they would never, ever, ever be used. They essentially counted what amounts to the pilot light in the flares, the pilot gas and the purge gas, and that's it. Those are the emissions you have when the flares are off. So a lot of funny math went into the very fishy conclusion from Indiana and from BP that there was going to be no pollution increase from this expansion.
Is it changing? Is it becoming harder for the corporations, especially the smokestack, air pollution involved corporations, corporations that have air pollution releases? Is it becoming harder for them to get away with that type of thing, or is it, is this just, the way it turned out in this individual situation? What's some, is there a bigger picture here?
I would call it a push-pull situation the last number of years. US EPA has a lot of very fine lawyers and engineers on staff who really want to see new source review enforced. These are not political appointees. They're people who want to do their jobs. The level to which US EPA is willing to let them do their jobs, I would have to say, varies politically. Under the past administration, there was a great push to weaken the regulations governing these expansions and essentially to create all kinds of loopholes so that the modern pollution control equipment could be avoided. Under the current administration, there is a stronger push for enforcement, and you don't see those efforts to weaken the regulations that are governing expansions.
Okay. Now, as far as, this particular progress has been made, can you describe for us the chain of events that led from, where you were when you filed the lawsuit to the EPA decision to require the changes in the air pollution permit that was, first issued, that has already been issued to the BP warning facility?
Sure. What we did when we first saw the permit and smelled the fish with all their calculations is we immediately hired an engineering expert who knows a lot about refineries to review the whole permit, and she confirmed that there was really a whole lot wrong with it. And we decided that since we were up against a big company, and this is a really critical issue, this question of tar sands expansions, which are only going to increase as we start importing more crude from Canada, we decided it was worth throwing everything at them. So that's really what we did. We filed an administrative challenge in Indiana to the permit. There's a process by which you can do that. We additionally filed a federal lawsuit on behalf of ourselves. The administrative challenge was on behalf of some local environmental groups, and the federal challenge essentially asked for more or less the same thing. Our claim was that they were, for all intents and purposes, proceeding without a permit to do this expansion because they had the wrong permit. And then the third thing we did was we asked US EPA to object to one of their permits. They had essentially gotten two companion permits. One was their permit to construct that allowed them to start building, and the second is their permit to operate, which of course will kick in and be required once the plant is up and running, which should happen in 2012 or 2013. We petitioned on the permit to operate, which the Clean Air Act allows us to do, and we went to EPA and told them what our issues were, and we asked them to step in and use their authority to oversee these permits to tell Indiana to go do it right. So the administrative challenge we filed with Indiana is still pending. We essentially put that on hold when we won the petition to US EPA. The federal challenge, the court essentially told us on procedural grounds that it wasn't going to deal with it because it was really something that Indiana should do. Obviously not a decision that we agreed with, but federal courts will often work to limit their jurisdiction in that way, and that's what the court did. But on the third, the petition to US EPA, although we spent the greater part of a year aggressively litigating in Indiana, kind of in the middle of that when we were preparing for hearing, US EPA came down with its decision and said, we got to step back and take a look at this, and they essentially adopted most of our reasoning. They said, you guys have omitted some major sources of emissions. You've got to figure out what those emissions are. You've got to do the math again. And if the math says that you are increasing your emissions significantly, then you've got to put on the pollution control equipment. And at this point, Indiana and US EPA are still trying to work out what that means.
Okay. Yeah, so that's a very complex matter that they're beginning to get into now, truly far more complex than anything they've dealt with so far on the whole permit, because first of all, just the facility, BP Whiting, cheating and just coming up with numbers that would appear to create a situation where they didn't have to comply with the Clean Air Act, the new source review, to now actually doing it right, and doing it right is, I'm sure, it's very complicated. What changes in the permit are needed to create compliance with the Clean Air Act?
Well, basically what they have to do is they have to add in all of their real sources of emissions. I mentioned the flares. There's also the coker, which is a very critical part of processing Canadian crude. And it's a really very dirty process. I can't overemphasize that enough. What a coker does is it separates out the very heavy elements of this heavy crude, which has more heavy elements, and they kind of collect as this black BB type material around the outsides of what's called a coke drum. And then what they do when they're done with that process is they vent to the atmosphere out of this coke drum, and that venting contains things like volatile organic compounds and hydrogen sulfide, all pollutants that you really need to limit in the atmosphere. They're very harmful. And then once you've done that, you take a high-powered water spray jet and you break off this the black coke material off the side of the coal drum. And as you can imagine, that kicks up all kinds of soot, particulate matter, which is very hazardous to people's lungs. There are more volatile organic compounds, which include things like benzene and carcinogens, that are trapped in the pores that get released when you do that. So they drop the stuff out, and then they convey it away to be used for various types of fuel. But, all in all, it's a very dirty process, and the facility in calculating their emissions didn't calculate any of that. So they need to calculate it, and once they figure out, which I'm fairly confident they will, at least for some pollutants, that the pollution is going to increase, they need to put on pollution controls that are going to limit it, because that's exactly what they decided way back in 1977 was going to be required when you had an expansion like that.
And tell me, will the pollution controls have to be applied to the equipment that was already in place there and operating? Say if they just leave something that they were using, I'm sure they'll leave a lot of what they're using before. Will they have to then apply pollution control equipment to that as if they had built it all, from scratch right now?
It's basically pollutant by pollutant, and mostly what they'll need to do is to address the equipment that's actually increasing its pollution. But in some cases, their solution might be to put additional controls on existing equipment.
Okay. Yeah, it just seems to me like there is certainly a lot of potential for the facility to continue to emit at a level that is truly harmful. Considering the fact that they're starting out with a facility that did not use air pollution control equipment to the extent that it was possible, over all these many years. And then they tried to cheat and, like you say, cook the numbers, present this illusion of what was being done, and are only changing this because they're being forced to. And then they had this tremendously dirty process that they're going to be overseeing and, conducting, operating. And then there's this whole matter of the air pollution control technology being far from perfect, and truly only limiting the emissions to a certain extent, not eliminating the emissions. And I just think about the Great Lakes Basin and all the toxics that are in that airshed and being downwind from that, where we are here in the St. Lawrence River Valley and the high rates of cancer we have. And we just feel so concerned about adding one molecule more of benzene or any of these particulates and the formaldehyde and the other VOCs and the sooty compounds, and plenty of persistent organics will come from this as well.
Well, it's a very valid concern. Just a couple of things about that. First of all, the problem that I'm discussing and you're mentioning about these decrepit old facilities continuing to operate and spew out their uncontrolled pollution is not just a problem with refineries or the Whiting refinery. It's really a widespread problem. It's something that I think the framers of this Clean Air Act provision back in 1977 just didn't really anticipate. The assumption, as I mentioned, was that old plants were going to shut down, but you have the unfortunate phenomenon now of all kinds of old coal plants built in the 40s and 50s that are also spewing out both toxics and conventional harmful pollutants that are continuing to operate. They just kind of cobble them together and hold them together just well enough to keep running. And they're going to run them into the ground until they just don't work anymore. There's a lot of that happening here in the Midwest, and unfortunately it's the East that can sometimes bear the brunt of that pollution given the prevailing winds. I would also say that it's our view overall in NRDC that these tar sands expansions just shouldn't be happening. I mean, the law is a limited tool. We're going after this permit with the tools of the law, and the law says that they have to control their pollution. But from the bigger picture view is that there are just a lot better ways for us to be getting our energy than tearing up the boreal forest in Canada, hauling the dirty crude down here, and polluting our lake and our atmosphere trying to process it. We really should be going full out to find alternatives, which we have. The alternatives are available now. They just need to be promoted. Right now, our government has been in the business of subsidizing and promoting these dirty fuels, and that just has to stop.
Hurrah for that. You know, we've been trying to do our part in preventing the tar sands from continuing to be a source of fuel, basically just to stop tar sands. We've tried to do that ever since a short time before that interview I did with you back over a year ago. And I see some progress. It was just great to see that one of the bishops, this Bishop Bouchard in Alberta in the diocese where the tar sands activity is located around Fort McMurray, he has come out with a paper on the lack of morality that is involved with doing tar sands exploitation. There's some really good groups, these water keepers groups that are bigger than just that one issue with the Athabasca River. And to say just that one issue is such a huge issue, it's not really the right way of expressing that. But it is good to see that people are joining together to fight and oppose and try to bring an end to something as awful, something as just horrible as the tar sands. I'm just happy to see that your lawsuit is flourishing, so to speak, and coming along and serving as an example of the right thing to do. There are other lawsuits. I'm going to have to become more familiar with them because I'm just so interested. There's one actually for the harm that has been caused to the woodland caribou there in Alberta. I think it's brought by one of the the native governments, First Nations. There's a lot really going on. I want to get more into the pipelines and the roads. There's also these proposals to construct these roads to make it easier to bring this equipment up into the Canadian, north. There's so much going on. I do feel like it's just truly one of the greatest challenges that people have ever faced, that they'd gotten to that stage where they understood about pollution and disease, and then there came this other change, another change that involved demand for new fuel supplies when the old supplies were dwindling. And now it's really this question of whether people are good enough to, have character and wisdom and reasonableness and just plain goodness of intention to use what they learned about pollution through all those decades, the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, and now apply it when it comes down to a bit of a crunch here with, the change in the fuel supply. And I'm just, it's something interesting. I find it very interesting to see what people are doing and to talk with them. There's a lot of really good vibe out there. Some of these people in Alberta, Canada, they're just so intense about not allowing this to happen to that beautiful place. And I hope it never happens in Saskatchewan, because that's a very beautiful place that I'm more familiar with than Alberta. I actually spent a winter out in Saskatchewan 2008, 2009.
Well, I have to agree with you that I think this is one of the greatest environmental challenges that we've faced of late. I think that the issue is both the massive destruction being wrought up in Alberta by these operations, but also the fact that pretty much all of the oil companies see tar sands as their future. They may talk a good game of being not just oil companies but energy companies, but I'm not sure even they know what that means. And I think that they have, for the most part, staked their fortunes in the world of dwindling oil supplies on being able to increasingly extract the oil from Canada. So we have the huge challenge of the forces us. But that said, I think that we have all collectively in the environmental community been making some real progress. And I think that the biggest obstacle in working against the oil industry and its efforts to extract is just making people aware of what's going on. Certainly in the U.S., when I talk to audiences about that, although it's changing somewhat, I often ask for a show of hands of who even knows what tar sands are. And the majority of people usually don't.
Right.
And yet this is the largest source of imported crude right now. Everybody thinks that we're getting it from Saudi Arabia and the Middle East, and we're not. We're getting the lion's share from Canada. And people are slowly becoming aware of that in the U.S. And meanwhile, in Canada, people are seeing some of the horrific things that are coming out of the tar sands. These incidents of the dead ducks and the effects of the tailings ponds on the native populations, the First Nations populations downstream, that stuff is getting airtime. People are sitting up and taking notice. And even in Alberta, where they're profiting from these tar sands operations, there are a lot of people saying, you've got to slow this down.
Yeah, I hear that from people out there. It's our residents, you know, say here in the U.S., and let me just kind of skip back a second. I was kind of missing a point here I want to make. Is anyone, are there any scientists, are any governments, is anything being done to say, and can it be done? Is it possible to know, say, to date, what have been the increases? You know, and this is probably a question that's just totally impossible to answer. But is anybody looking at this and thinking about, you know, what have the pollutant increases been from just starting up this tar sands and been doing it since way back in the 1960s, actually? You know, is anybody looking at the kind of trying to get some kind of handle on, say, how much this is increasing acid rain, or how much this is increasing the levels of benzene in the atmosphere, or the particulates, or the PAHs? That's probably not being done at all, is it?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think that there are a lot of efforts all around to understand that. It's not always easy. I think on the Canadian end, certainly there have been people looking at the impact of the tailings ponds on the Athabasca River, which flows downstream into the First Nations communities. There was a doctor up there who found an enormous cancer cluster of rare cancers. Yes. I'm sorry, what was that?
I'm trying to get an interview with him going, and
okay.
I'm looking forward to that, and I'm just glad that you're give us, you know, tell us about some of a few of the kind of like the really high profile things that are getting the media time now, that are getting, you know, that are starting to take off as far as concerns about tar sands.
Well, I can name a couple of them. One, as I mentioned, was the dead ducks incident. You may remember a couple of years ago when the tar sands extraction companies were all claiming that their tailings ponds really weren't that harmful and that they were, you know, taking care to sort of keep them from getting into the environment. 1,600 ducks landed on a Syncrude pond and they all died. That's the kind of thing that captures the public imagination. Unfortunately, things like parts per million of contaminants going into a river doesn't always capture people's imagination, but the dead ducks did, and that was publicized all over Canada and really kind of had a big negative impact on the tar sands operations. And there was another similar recent incident. I would also mention that 3 years ago, when the BP Whiting facility applied for its water permit, they got a significant expansion of their permission to discharge ammonia and total suspended solids, which is another word for sludge. And the sludge contains all kinds of toxic metals. The city of Chicago was in an uproar. I had really never seen anything like it. At the time, I really kind of compared it to when the Cuyahoga River caught on fire 40 years ago, and it prompted the Clean Water Act legislation shortly after. It was really the same level of anger and anxiety. You had people picketing BP stations. It was on the nightly news. You had a huge pile-on from the local congressional delegation. And ultimately, BP claimed to back down and said that they weren't going to use the additional headroom in their permit. Now, the other question is whether that's really going to be the case, because they didn't agree to actually change the permit. But nonetheless, I found that the public awareness and the public reaction to that to be very interesting and encouraging. And I think that we just need to get the public focused more and more on what's really happening, because like I said earlier, I don't think that people are really aware to the extent they need to be of what's happening to bring that crude into their gas tank.
Okay. Well, tell me, what is your strategy? What is your organization, the Natural Resources Defense Councils, and you know maybe some of your partner organizations as well? What's the strategy for getting the public up to speed on this problem with the tar sands? You know, how can we all work together to increase what the average American knows about tar sands, so that they can then start to do something about stopping this?
Short answer to that is any way we can. We use all the tools that are available to us. We take legal action when we can, and when we take that action, we try to make sure that people know about it. We've challenged the proposed Keystone XL pipeline that would take the crude to the Gulf. And have tried to make sure that the public knows about that. We try to tell particular interest groups about why tar sands extraction is going to hurt them. And one example of that is that a lot of migratory birds depend on the boreal forest. And if you tear down the boreal forest, you're going to hurt those birds. There are a lot of bird lovers in the U.S. NRDC has actually started a social networking site for birders called We Love Birds. And, you know, people go on that and they trade information about what they saw and what they want to see and that sort of thing. But it also provides an opportunity to share information about the kinds of things that are hurting birds that are going on in the boreal forest. So ways like that, we try to be creative in reaching people who might not otherwise be paying attention. I recently gave a talk in my church where I presented information about tar sands and what it was doing and framed it as a moral issue, just like the bishop did.
That sounds, you know, it's cool the way you guys are being creative about this and just putting, I can tell you put a lot of passion and just depth of human beingness into this work that you're doing, and I'm sure that's showing a good example, and other people are seeing that, and maybe they are all just kind of ready to jump into that too and become that kind of a person and live that kind of life and kind of create those kind of results. We have been trying so hard to get the media to take some interest in this. We feel that, geez, you'd think that New York State would be the perfect place. We have such high cancer rates. We're located downwind from so much. Many scientists are taking the position that the reason we have these high cancer rates is because we are located downwind from so much. There's all that data from the Great Lakes about the air toxics that exist in the Great Lakes air mm-hmm. supply. It's clear that there's no sound-minded person that would conclude otherwise than that if we go ahead with tar sands, the air quality in the Great Lakes will decline. And it's already too dirty. If, you know, let's just nail that down. If tar sands, if this exploitation of tar sands continues, you know, year, you know, another year, and just becomes, you know, full-flung and is just the way things are being done. If that happens, will air quality in the Great Lakes and in New York State decline?
Well, it's hard to give a direct answer to that question in the sense that there are ways to control the pollution. And if they put on the best state-of-the-art pollution control equipment, maybe they could hold their emissions down. I'm not sure the answer to that, frankly, because no one's really tried. All of the companies are looking for ways not to have to use state-of-the-art pollution controls. But I would also say that really the best you could do is keep the problem from getting any worse. And what we really need to be doing is trying to make the problem better. And the only way that you're going to do that is by not repeating our mistakes of using these dirty fuels, you know, what we call the caveman energy, digging it up out of the ground and burning it.
Right. Yeah, and truly, I know what you're saying. I know that you are being, you know, careful about, you know, what you're stating about these matters because, you know, you want to be right on with what you're saying. But just stepping back a little from that and just thinking about how it's gone, you know, just kind of like the history, how dirty it has been, how much resistance there has been to cleaning up, and then to add on this huge source of, you know, it didn't even exist. There was no dirty oil refining going on. And then just all of a sudden, boom, we're doing that big time. To add that on top of all, like you say, the coal-fired power plants, and, well, there's more driving than ever before. So many cars on the highways, you know, everywhere, and they're, you know, some of them are cleaner cars, but plenty of them are, you know, cars that put out a considerable amount of pollution. And we see the diesel trucking. With diesel trucking now, there's so much of that activity going on. I talked to there's a New York State police here in New York State. We have state police that deal with highways. They have a commercial vehicles unit. I talked to their captain, this Captain Walzer. He says to me, diesel truck idling is out of control in New York, in the U.S. There have been efforts to deal with it, but in the end, you know, when the trucks are parked at the truck stop at night and the pollution is being emitted from the idling trucks, this is an out-of-control situation. We don't know what to do about it. You know, we're going to keep trying. And so, you know, look at all that going on. I have a deep sense of foreboding about what the air quality of New York State and the other Great Lakes states are going to be like, and the province of Ontario, considering, you know, the history. And in this new add-on, you know, there's this matter of tar sands becoming a big part of what's going on. I have another question about, you know, what's going on with people. Are the residents of the communities that are impacted by BP whiting emissions, are they continuing to work for implementation of strict emissions limitations? And are they even beginning to think, well, we don't want this at all. You know, we don't like the sounds of this tar sands. We don't like what is happening in Alberta, these ducks dying off, the songbirds being harmed. You know, we really want, you know, we've become aware of this because of this refinery expansion, you know, right here in our midst. And now that we know enough about that, we're kind of tracking down some other issues here with the tar sands. And we decided we don't want it, and we're going to fight this. Is that happening in your part of the world?
I would have to call that a mixed bag. On the one hand, certainly we've been working with some local groups, with a lot of local members who are really fed up with the idea of the kind of pollution that's going to be dumped into the lake and into the atmosphere as a result of this expansion, and they just don't want it. I think there is a whole other set of people who, while they're not really happy with the additional pollution, are kind of desperate right now in these economic times and therefore are likely to be persuaded by the kind of media and public relations that you hear from BP, which is, we're creating jobs, these environmentalists, you know, want to take away your jobs, and therefore you shouldn't support them. Now, of course, if you scratch the surface of that, it's not remotely true, because first of all, there are only about 80 permanent jobs that they're going to be creating through this facility, and if you turn to green energy, then there would be really potentially a lot more jobs created, you know, local good jobs, you know, the steel mills can make steel for the wind turbines and, you know, you've got all of the housing retrofits and all of that. But still, it's people don't think that way when they're in desperate straits during a recession. And I sympathize with how that feels, but, you know, sometimes that holds back some of the community support we could be getting.
Yeah, it's it is truly, it's just reality, and it's an unfortunate reality that it is so hard. You know, I guess maybe to give a little bit of, you know, kind of even-handedness to the whole story we're discussing here. It is truly hard for people to have what they need, really, even. And there should be some changes. People should, like, really think about what they need and cut back and try to live more simply. But in the end, it truly is hard for people to survive, you know, to have the food, have the clothing, have the shelter, have the kids, have the, you know, grandparents, have the, you know, everything that people need to exist. And there is a hardness to that, and I can understand why people, you know, starting off, say, several hundred years ago, that they did, you know, not be especially careful about nature, because nature seemed like something that was hard, and it was hurting them, and that they wanted to dominate it and, you know, just get what they wanted out of the resources and the earth. And now as we're coming to see the, you know, the hardness of having done that, you know, with all the cancer and all these other chronic diseases that are caused by exposure to these pollutants, you know, that's another hard part of life. And now we get these economic downturns where the whole world is kind of like hitting a road bump as far as the change in fuel. And certainly there's many other things going on too, and I'm certain a huge part of that is dealing with a lot of sick people. You know, if you have this, you know, this world where people sought to benefit themselves, and they kind of got, well, not kind of, but it certainly did get way out of control with, you know, the greed that exists in human beings and the lack of caring and concern, and all this pollution was created, and then so many people have been harmed by that and become sick. You know, people that have cancer, people that have kids that have cancer, people that have parents that have cancer, brothers and sisters that have cancer, and these other diseases like heart disease and diabetes, these diseases clearly becoming known to have been caused by exposure to pollutants. When that kind of civilization, that kind of society exists, they cannot do the work, they cannot produce the value and create the products that satisfy the needs. They just can't do it. They are spending too much of their time suffering and dealing with suffering. That's an add-on. That's another add-on. You know, this whole thing of, okay, we're all sick now, let's add that on, you know, to our plate and deal with that. Well, it kind of seems to me obvious that there would be some downturning going on when so many people have been harmed and continue to be harmed. That has to be taken into account when we're thinking about where our society's at with, you know, what we do, including, you know, the economics. It's a big part of it. Sure.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the problems in our country in getting people to appreciate what's really happening is that we have a frontier mentality. That's not entirely a bad thing in and of itself, but, you know, we came to this country and the frontier seemed limitless. We could do what we wanted. We could always build something bigger and better. And that's still the spirit with which we approach the land. And it's very hard to get people to realize that the frontier mentality has to be reined in. We can still apply it to some things about the way we live, but not to the way we treat the land and the water and the atmosphere. That we need to transfer the frontier mentality that says we're just going to build more things to saying we're going to build things better. We are going to stop using caveman energy, and we're going to use our American ingenuity, and we're going to build much better sources of energy, and we're going to beat the Chinese in the race to have green energy. That needs to be our attitude and our approach. And until that happens, unfortunately, we will continue poisoning ourselves.
I just had this desire to ask you, what do you believe in? You know, what do you believe will, you know, there has to be, it's either that doesn't happen. If that doesn't happen, then we're just kind of, you know, going down this, well, that book, Dirty Oil and the Future of a Continent, you know, that portrays this matter of slipping deeper into a morass, you know, quagmire, a bad situation if we take this path. What do you believe in that could prevent, you know, stop that from happening and just turn this into this world that you are, you know, cheering for and, you know, kind of leading the way toward with people caring enough and people just doing, thinking clearly and changing their ways from this frontier mentality to live this path that doesn't lead down that steep decline?
Well, I think what's really critical is for people to come to understand this as a moral issue. I think those of us working in the environmental profession are very knee-deep in facts and statistics, all of which are important. But people are not often persuaded by that or by that alone. People need to understand that this is an issue of ethics, and it's an issue of values. And in every election recently, values have been very important. But I think sometimes we view the issue of values too narrowly, and I think it's very important that people come to understand that this is really an issue of values and ethics and morality too. And I'm encouraged by things like the bishop coming out in Canada saying this is a moral issue and we have to confront it as such, because I think ultimately that is the kind of thing that can persuade people.
Well, tell me, how did the people in your church respond to your presentation?
Well, they were deeply concerned, and they responded in the way that I hoped they would and said, this is wrong. And as Christians, we need to find ways to try to oppose this and to participate in it as little as possible.
That's, you know, so encouraging to hear. We haven't, our group has not gone the route of, say, reaching out to churches, and maybe we should add that on, because there certainly are a lot of churches in this part of New York State. There's a lot of both Roman Catholic churches and the Methodists and the Presbyterians, these more, you know, basically, I don't know how to say it, but, you know, the more standard.
The mainline churches.
Exactly. And then there's also a lot of evangelical type churches. So there's a lot of religion here in northern New York State and in the New York State. We have not tried that. What we've done, we've tried to go directly to local government. We felt that there was this opportunity. There's the opportunity to speak. There's the opportunity to know the people better. There's the opportunity to really be more a part of what's done at the local level of government. So we've gone to town governments and county governments all throughout New York State and tried to educate the policymakers about this one group of pollutants that we feel are of great concern, these POPs, the persistent organic pollutants, dioxins, PCBs, a lot of old pesticides, a lot of, you know, chemicals, even some new chemicals like the PBDEs that are flame retardants, and make the point that unless major changes are brought about, that these chemicals, with the body burdens that people have and the level of contamination in the environment and the practices that go on, such as feeding waste animal fat to food animals, that this will harm people for many generations, that there's already a huge amount of harm has been created, especially with the cancer risk imposed. And we're finding that the town governments and the county governments, a little less, but somewhat, are responsive to this message. But then we hit this roadblock, this kind of wall, where the federal government and the state government control the county health departments to the extent that, you know, we'll get all the way to the goal line almost of having the county health department do something, and then it all falls apart on us because the federal government, the CDC, the Health and Human Services, the National Cancer Institute, in the case of cancer causation, and trying to do some of that as far as prevention goes and reducing exposure to pollutant carcinogens. These top dogs, so to speak, they run the show so much at the county level that we'll have health department directors just say, well, we're doing enough. You know, we're doing what they tell us to do. I'd like to, you know, maybe you could give us some thoughts on how to, you know, follow our path here with trying to deal with the local governments and, you know, get them on board as far as recognizing that pollution causes disease and that things need to be done differently, or we're going to keep having the same results. You know, you just can't keep polluting, and then expect to have healthy people. And truly, Medicaid is the highest cost of county governments here in New York State, and I'm sure it's the same way everywhere, because sick people cost a lot of money to give, you know, this high level of health care to. And then they don't want to, you know, just get sick and then not do anything about it. They're very active in getting health care.
Well, I wish I had a silver bullet for you, but I don't. It's a frustrating situation. I can hear that. But many times, changing public attitudes requires just chipping away at them steadily, and I hope you keep doing what you're doing. I think very often people are receptive to messages about cancer, that there are things that you can control in your diet and lifestyle to limit it. But unfortunately, a message, you know, that message in some ways excludes these environmental factors. And
exactly.
I think it's very important that you keep pushing on helping people to understand that it's not just their behavior that's contributing to cancer risk. It's things that are being put into their environment, into the air and the water, that they can't really get away from, and they just have to prevent those things from being done.
Yeah, the President's Cancer Panel, when they brought their report out in May of 2010, making it clear that pollution is a huge part of cancer causation. You know, exposure to pollution is a huge part of what is damaging the genes of Americans and people around the world and causing these high cancer rates. This, truly, we're seeing a cancer epidemic here in the St. Lawrence River Valley. One of our cancer treatment centers, this is the Richard Winter Cancer Treatment Center, they just published a whole new line of public educational literature coming directly from them that's stating that they're seeing these great increases in testicular cancer, male breast cancer. Their brochures actually guide the man and the woman now to do self-exam for these reproductive type cancers and these cancers of the reproductive system. It's very concern-raising to see that this is the course of events. You know, this is what's taking place, because I had decided a long time ago, you know, decades ago, that there was way too much cancer up here already, and all it's done is continued to get worse. And it's because of the pollution that we receive from the Midwest. So your facility there, this BP Whiting, is really high on, you know, our radar screen. We think a lot about, you know, what's taking place out there and how it's harming people here in the St. Lawrence River Valley. I'm so glad to have you.
Well, I'm really glad. Sorry, go ahead.
It's really good to have the opportunity to talk with you. And it's just so nice to know that there's somebody with your passion and your clear-mindedness and your hard-workingness that's on this team of stopping the tar sands from, you know, I think that if we have the dirty coal-burning plants, and there's plenty of coal, you know, to keep using, and they'll keep using that, they're just so stuck in that. I just can't hardly, you know, just accept that we would now go this route of adding on the tar sands. It just seems like such a novel thing. I'm so glad you guys are fighting it.
Well, it sounds like you're doing God's work out there, too. Keep it up.
Well, anything more that you want to add before we wrap this up?
I think we've pretty much covered everything.
I think we have, too. And I'm glad you say this of God's work. I'm this good spirits, you know, kind of person. I really believe that there are powerful spiritual entities of goodness, and that there are also powerful spiritual entities of badness and even certainly evil. And so I'm glad that you're talking that talk and making that a part of this discussion and this change that's going to take place. I certainly, what I believe in, I asked you what you believe in, what I believe in is that there are good spiritual powers, but there are times when those good spiritual powers are struggling and not, you know, not on top, not winning. I just had this sense that the good spiritual powers have come to a time of winning now, and this is going to get better and better in this spiritual realm. I'm really looking forward to the experience of it.
Well, it's encouragement to keep fighting the good fight.
Yeah, exactly. Well, thanks so much, Anne. I hope you have a great Thanksgiving holiday. You know, that's truly this Thanksgiving that's coming up on us now. It's truly probably the best holiday that we have ever come up with in the, you know, the U.S. and Canada, you know, in whatever parts of the world that also celebrate it. And there's so much about spirituality and goodness and the land. It's just this perfect holiday, really, to really focus on to bring about these changes that we want.
Absolutely. Well, happy Thanksgiving to you, too.
Yeah, happy Thanksgiving to you, Anne. Have a nice day.
You too. Bye.
This has been a Cancer Action Network radio program. We call our series Loving the Earth, Pollution-Free Revolution. There truly can come a time when people care enough, love enough, are good enough, are high enough spiritually, and just get it all together to to have a pollution-free world. We don't need to follow the dirty old dinosaurs and the, you know, the greed and the arrogance and the lack of love and the lack of good intention. We don't need to let that lead the way. We can take charge. We can revolt against that bad intention and these bad paths. You know, just demand that the paths of loving the earth and caring about public health and being moral and being people of goodness, we can demand that that is the course of our nation and that those paths are followed, and which in my book means Stop Tar Sands. So this has been a Stop Tar Sands interview with Ann Alexander of the Natural Resources Defense Council. I'm hoping that everybody's getting into this vibe of good intentions. Love the earth, love your body, cancer-free world. Bye. Happy Thanksgiving.